Welcome to the Pick Six Podcast. Evan Bland, still at the wintry Memorial Stadium. Sam McEwen here in the house. Not in my mother's basement, but in my own. Evan, how you doing?
Hanging in, Sam. You know,
busy week for Evan Bland. Busy week for Evan. Busy week. Thank you for all you've done this week. Good scoop yesterday on the Husker player lawsuit. Interesting stuff going on in that particular realm of the world. We will discuss. We're going to discuss that. We're definitely going to discuss the player lawsuit. What they're looking for. What the machinations of the court proceedings were yesterday. We're going to talk about recruiting. Thomas Fedoni, Kobe Bretts, and potentially, in the next 3 to 5 days, A.J. Rollins. Not sure if he's going to Nebraska, but he's going to be making a decision very soon. So Nebraska's went on sort of a local recruiting run. We'll talk about the impact of Thomas Fedoni's commit, the impact of Cody Brett's commit. I'm going to go watch Heinrich Harburg tonight, the Kearney Catholic quarterback out in Scafford's old stomping grounds, Wood River. Unfortunately, I don't think Scott can be there because they don't allow them to recruit. Maybe he can say he's going back to his old high school. Which he would be, but that'll be interesting to go poke around a little bit and see what's what out there in central Nebraska. Always like visiting there. I lived in Grand Island for 3.5 years, I think. So I think I even took in a Scott Frost Wood River game. Not like, I don't know, he wouldn't have been a senior. I know that. I think he was like a sophomore, so maybe he wasn't there yet. I'm not sure. But I know I went to a Wood River football game. So anyway, we'll talk a little bit about that, and then we'll wrap it up with the Nebraska men's basketball team made a statement against racial injustice and police violence yesterday. We'll talk a little bit about that statement and how it fit into the larger context of a busy week on the sports front after the shooting of Jacob Clark earlier this week. I want to remind everybody that our sponsor is Team Schwalbach. The Schwalbach Agency is a family-owned Allstate insurance agency with 4 licensed insurance pros, saving thousands of Nebraska Husker fans money. They sell homeowner, auto, life, and flood insurance across Nebraska, and they also insure all the big boy toys, motorcycles, boats, RVs, off-road vehicles. You'll probably be using more of those this fall now that there isn't any Nebraska football. If you've had your roof replaced in the last 5 years, give Daryl Schwalbach, Kyle Schwalbach, Nancy Mossack, or Kyle Murdoch a call at 402-590-5200. They can help you save a bundle. They're going to have free, no-obligation insurance reviews and quotes. They're going to make sure that all of their fellow Nebraska fans are properly protected. You can contact them at 402-590-5200 or www.nebraskaallstate.com. That's www.nebraskaallstate.com. Thank you to Team Schwalbach. Evan, you have become our Husker parent and player letter and lawsuit beat reporter. I took it initially, but then I was like, you know, I think this is actually going to end with the next letter. And so it was a day when I was doing something else, and so I asked you to do it, and now you've just continued. And you got a really good scoop yesterday that Nebraska players were going to be filing a lawsuit against the Big Ten. 8 Nebraska players did that. That lawsuit was filed, and the first court hearing was yesterday at 3 p.m. in Lancaster County Court down here on, 9th Street? Yeah, 9th Street. 10th Street? 9th Street? Yeah. One of them.
Between the two, yeah.
10th Street. So, yeah, right over there. And they had to conduct that via Zoom because of the coronavirus. But, yeah, you've gathered a lot of data and information. You've talked to Husker parents a lot. You've talked to Mike Flood, the lawyer representing the parents, and now the players quite a bit. What have you gathered in the last week or so on this story? And where is it going now?
Yeah, that's – It's a big, kind of a big thing to unpack, but, you know, it of course started with the Big Ten postponing fall sports and the way that it did so with kind of that lack of transparency festered with a lot of the parents. You know, Nebraska parents were the first to come out against that after the Nebraska leadership did initially, and then they kind of settled down and have kind of accepted what this fall will look like without football. But Nebraska parents continued on. They have teamed up with 10 other Big Ten schools. So everybody with the exception of Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Indiana, they've come together to pen kind of an aligned message supporting their sons' respective programs, but coming out against Big Ten leadership, specifically Kevin Warren. But the first kind of inkling we got of any kind of legal action, came a week ago when Nebraska parents laid down an ultimatum against the Big Ten and said, you know, we want to know who voted which way. We want records of that meeting. We want to see the medical data that was used in making the decision. And they had until this previous Monday to deliver those documents. And that deadline passed without any kind of communication from the Big Ten. And so then, as we said on Wednesday, eight Nebraska players came out and they were the ones to officially sue the Big Ten through Mike Flood. Obviously, a lot of these players are doing so kind of with the support of their parents, and through that, they're not doing this on their own. Certainly when I was 19 or 20, I would have had no idea how or when or why to sue somebody as big as the Big Ten. But they put that out there, and then they had a motion to try to, for early discovery is what they called it, where they're trying to, in a timely fashion, get those documents from the Big Ten. They believe, because, first of all, those documents shouldn't be all that hard for the Big Ten to procure. They haven't been, they should be easily accessible and easily transferable. And also with the idea that, Nebraska was supposed to play a football game next week. And so they wanted to get that going. It was about a half hour Zoom session yesterday afternoon. And what I thought was interesting from that session, Sam, was not necessarily what Nebraska's attorneys or Nebraska players' attorneys said, which was already laid out pretty well in the lawsuit and the complaint. It was more from what the Big Ten said. Their attorney was there. They felt like that the Big Ten didn't fall under Freedom of Information Act law. They felt like they were outside of that. They felt like the arguments that Nebraska player attorneys made stretch legal law to its limits. I mean, they felt like they were really stretching out. They echoed what the Big Ten statement said in terms of this case has no merit. And then they also said, look, if we can prove there was a vote, then what you're saying in your lawsuit more or less goes away, because the argument from Husker player attorneys has been that the Big Ten didn't follow its own procedures in its decision-making process, didn't have an official vote. So the Big Ten says, hey, if we can prove that there was a vote, then that should be the end of it. So they believe that this thing will end quickly. They have until this coming Monday, the Big Ten does, to write a statement in response to the motion for early discovery. So there'll be, a few more days here at least until that wraps up. But we'll have to see where it goes, but this thing's in the court officially. And if nothing else, I think, Husker player attorneys believe that this keeps the public pressure on the Big Ten, keeps the conversation going, and doesn't let this thing die just yet.
What do you think the purpose is of, I guess you just kind of answered this, what do you think the purpose of the lawsuit is? Do you think it's to get an opportunity to play football this fall? Do you think it's to get the Big Ten to, officially say which schools voted for and which schools voted against the postponement, or if you prefer, for and against football?
Yeah, I mean, it lays it out in the complaint that their main goal, and parents have said this too, is to play football this fall. I think most of us can kind of look at the situation and know that that's a long, long, long shot to happen at this point, that they would reverse that. I mean, Nebraska football players took 2 weeks off from practice. They just came back this week. The odds that the Big Ten would reverse a decision like that, just astronomical at this point. But in anything like this, you shoot for the moon, and if you don't get it, then hopefully you at least get that transparency. And I think that's really what this is about, is they want some answers. They want accountability from presidents and chancellors, which direction they voted. They don't want them to be able to hide behind kind of these closed door meetings. They want some accountability there, and then they want specifically to know what medical data the Big Ten used in coming to this decision, whether the myocarditis factor, how heavily that weighed. They want to know how outdated maybe some of that information is from when they made that decision 2.5 weeks ago. And again, they believe that there's still enough time to play a season now. You know, the SEC, some of your other Power Five schools aren't starting still for another, you know what, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe even. And so,
yep. So the SEC starts on September 26th.
So you know, theoretically, there is still time to turn this around. They believe if they can shine some light on this thing. And as you reported, Sam, with kind of the silo discussions that they had up to this point, they just believed that information was not considered properly, was not applied properly from all parties concerned. So again, the grand view would be to play this fall, but I think more realistically, they're just saying, look, we want to hold some people accountable. We want to know why this decision was laid down and it's affecting us and it's so many other people for the next few months.
I'm a little surprised that they didn't functionally sue the Big Ten universities that they think voted to postpone, because with the exception of Northwestern, all of those are public universities, and any discussion that they had via their public university email or, you know, phone calls, things like that. I know there was some website out there. There's a million websites now that do this stuff, but there was a website out there that got, for example, emails from Ted Carter and Ronnie Green. Well, you can do that in part because it's public data, right? Now, there's a Nebraska state law that I think shields Nebraska state senators. I can't remember if that's accurate, but something like that. Or regents. It's not regents, though. But anyway, I guess what I would say is that I'm surprised they didn't do that, because the Big Ten is a sort of nonprofit private corporation, so to speak, a private business, if you will. Can probably argue, hey, yeah, you can't get our stuff. Like you can't get the NFL stuff. You can't get Major League Baseball, the NBA. Like, nobody's going to sue to get Adam Silver's emails that he's had over the last week, or sue to get Roger Goodell's emails that he's had over the last week. You can't really get that data, but you can get it through the universities themselves. So the point that I think the Big Ten lawyers are making, in the sense of like, look, we're not subject to this, you know, you can't just extract private data from a private corporation unless there's a crime and there's some sort of, you know, you're compelling it based on criminal discovery. And to be very honest, I think that's pretty accurate. What is not, what I'd be curious to see is if, because I know the lawyer Tom Mars has submitted FOIAs to these public universities, and those places probably do have to produce documents. In other words, the Big Ten is not Fight Club. Like, any and all topics that relate to the Big Ten are not verboten from being shared if it went through a public university system. Now, if the Big Ten's hosting a Zoom call, then, and that's Big Ten property, in other words, it was launched by the Big Ten's, whatever you want to call it, okay. But if for some reason there was a Zoom call that was started by the Ohio State University, and the Ohio State University owns the launching place of the Zoom call, in other words, it's their data or it's their email system, I think you can get that. The other piece is that I'm very confident there was a vote. I think Nebraska knows there was a vote. I think some of the misdirection that we've seen has just been people trying to sort of fog up the mirror, but there's a vote. There was a vote. It was probably, I'm pretty confident it was 11-3. Ohio State, Iowa, Nebraska. Those are the ones that wanted football and the other ones did not. So I would guess that Nebraska knows what that vote is. If it was 11-3, 12-2, 8-6, whatever, they know what the vote is. So I'm guessing that it's more to produce an official answer from the Big Ten on who voted what, so that schools can go back to those presidents and say, okay, now can you tell me why you voted for this?
Yeah, I agree. And some of the counts, I think the count that's going to probably not last all that long is this breach of contract, excuse me, count where they feel like they contend that the Big Ten it is violating its contract with the student athletes. But the Big Ten argued on its session that, you know, there is no such contract between the conference as an entity and those student athletes, and that it comes down to the schools. And so I think the part that's a little bit interesting, the part that's a little bit more interesting to me is this idea of wrongful interference with businesses. When you start bringing in name, image, likeness legislation, and then the idea that a postponed or canceled season costs them the chance to improve their brand, to profit from their brand, costs them the chance to potentially have a career in the NFL. You know, that's a little bit more interesting to me, but, you know, if nothing else, again, even if this thing lasts another week and goes away, I think their primary goal is to continue to ratchet up public pressure to get the Big Ten to say something, anything, which they already have now to this point. And then at some point, you know, you move on from there.
Yeah, the implication of restricting business practices assumes that, for example, you could sue a school that closes. In other words, you know, the Iowa swimmer and divers can say, well, we're going to sue the University of Iowa for shutting down our sport because we might have gotten, you know, a better job based on swimming at Iowa. Or a school can't cancel a really important football game because of a national tragedy, because that game was going to be the opportunity that, you know, a player had to, you know, show up on the national stage. That seems pretty unlikely to me that you would be able to achieve that. As it relates to the contract, I think the Big Ten is right. I think the contract is with the schools, and the school is not bound to stay in the Big Ten. They're not bound to stay in it. They're not bound to, I mean, at the end of the day, Nebraska is not bound by the Big Ten's decision. They are bound by the Big Ten's decision insofar as they want to stay in the Big Ten and don't want to run afoul of it. In other words, consequent of, like, if Nebraska said, screw it, we're going to be Trey Lance's other showcase game, right? And we're going to play North Dakota State whether the Big Ten likes it or not. We're going to play this game. Well, my sense is the Big Ten's not going to send, you know, a policing force to Memorial Stadium to stop it from happening. What they're going to do is they're going to vote Nebraska out of the Big Ten. That's how they'll enforce that act. And so, you know, Nebraska is not technically bound. They can leave the Big Ten and they can become an independent and play whoever the hell they want. The challenge that comes into play is you don't want to run the risk of bringing the Big Ten's ire, because you're put out on an island. And Ohio State, at the end of the day, is not leaving the Big Ten, even if they agree with you. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. So by Monday at 5:00, the Big Ten's got to respond, right?
Yeah, they have to respond to this.
Now, the court's not going to rule Monday evening. They're going to rule what, Tuesday?
Probably Tuesday. I think the idea, the way that the hearing wrapped up, was the Big Ten has to respond Monday by 5:00, and then Nebraska player attorneys were going to respond first thing Tuesday morning. So that's probably when we'll see.
And then a judge has got to read it and so on and so forth. Yeah. The last argument the Big Ten made was that this belongs in a federal court and not in a Lancaster County court. And considering the Big Ten's entity does not exist here, I think its headquarters are in Chicago, it would not stun me to see the Lancaster County Court say this belongs in a different court.
Yeah, very well could be. I mean, their argument for starting it here is that the Big Ten conducts business here, and they do. Yeah. They have representation here, but yeah, it could move to federal court.
Well, the representation here is the Nebraska. It's right. Interesting. I guess I would say, you know, when the student athletes who are you know, filing suit against the NCAA as it relates to Title IX violations with sexual assaults, you know, they filed that course. They sued Michigan State, and I think they've also sued Nebraska now. They filed that in federal court. They didn't file. I don't think they filed it in Lancaster County Court, because you got to file in a federal district court to sue the NCAA. I don't think you can sue the NCAA. I mean, I guess you could sue the NCAA in Indianapolis in that court, but I don't think you can sue the NCAA you know, anywhere in any local court without it just being moved to federal court, if that makes sense. So I don't know. I guess we'll find out. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a legal expert. I was just reading it, kind of thinking about it. And like some of the Big Ten's arguments make sense. Some of the Big Ten arguments don't. The whole, like, I mean, the Big Ten can't reveal anything. Well, I think they can, in the sense that if it's on university letterhead and it's something that the university received or sent, or there was a correspondence between Kevin Warren and a public university official on email, I don't think the Big Ten can protect that. They're not Fight Club. It's not a state secret. It's not national security. Anyway, great week recruiting for Nebraska. What a great week overall. I think they've got two commits this week. One of them from Kobe Brett's, the Omaha West Side safety / defensive athlete. I think he could play a lot of positions in college, but definitely a safety right now at West Side. They got his commit, and then they got the big one on Wednesday night from Thomas Fedoni. Really good job of KATV kind of hosting that. You don't see those much anymore. I guess I kind of missed it. Like, I kind of missed seeing a hat ceremony, and it was sweet. It was very sweet. You know, they obviously love doing that. And then, of course, Mike Sauter did a great job of talking to Thomas and kind of getting the inside scoop as to why he picked Nebraska. Evan, you've talked to him a couple of times. You've written a couple stories, and you were in that high school scene in Council Bluffs for a long time. I've always appreciated your experience in that way. So one of the schools you covered a lot, I think, was Council Bluffs Lewis Central. But you covered Western Iowa for how many years? A decade?
8 years, yeah. Eight.
So, you know, I think you've known every player that's kind of rolled through there. You know, Brandon Sheriff's probably the best guy to roll through that part of the state. He's obviously in the NFL now. Brett Meyer was a special player too. But can you put into context for our listeners just how good Thomas Fedoni is compared to the players that rolled through there since 2008, 2009 in Western Iowa, and all the – and your coverage area was pretty vast, actually. So you know quite a bit about the territory.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, that area has had some Division I athletes. Actually, you know, Fremont Mills, that where Seth Malcolm's coming out of, they had Nate Meyer. He
was
a couple multi-year starter for Iowa along the line there for a while. You know, Jake Waters was a St. Albert kid who went to Kansas State to play quarterback.
He was a great player at Kansas State. Yeah.
So, you know, they've had a few players come out of there, but it you're right. I've spent a lot of time at Lewis Central over the years covering different things, and it's just – it hits different when you see, you know, in the winter, Jim Harbaugh sitting in the second row of the gym watching Thomas Fedoni play basketball, or you see, you know, representatives from Missouri and Georgia and LSU showing up to Western Iowa. And, you know, not to get on too much of a thing about that, but that part of the state – of Iowa, I've always kind of appreciated because it's less populated compared to the eastern part. It's quite a bit more undercovered than the eastern part of the state. There's always been kind of an underdog mentality, kind of a chip on the shoulder sort of approach to sports in that area. So for a guy like Thomas Fedoni to be the top one or two rated tight end in the country coming out of Western Iowa, I mean, that's a big deal for that place. And, you know, he put in the work. He went through the camp circuit. He broke out at that All-American Combine in San Antonio last January. That's really when he got on national radars. But, yeah, it's a big deal. And you know, I was trying to think of some other recruits under Frost at Nebraska where they really just put in the work, and landed a guy. And, you know, I think of – Adrian Martinez with the whole kind of cross-country flight that Frost did, going to Fresno to talk to him and then back to Orlando to coach UCF. I think of kind of what they did with Wandale Robinson in 2019, how he commits to Kentucky, but they stick with him and he shows up. Ty Robinson, where they were on him and beat out Alabama and some others for him. This is the same kind of deal. I mean, Ed Orgeron's talking to Thomas Fedoni daily, the reigning national champion head coach. And, you know, ultimately, as much as this pandemic has hurt Nebraska in a lot of ways, it's almost certainly cost them recruits along the way. I think in this case, it definitely played to their advantage because Fedoni never was able to take that official visit to LSU. He was never able to get to Notre Dame or Michigan or some other places that he wanted to check out. And, you know, you got to credit Nebraska for filling that void with peer recruiting, pretty much relentless peer recruiting to stay in his ear. They got him to Lincoln for a players only visit. You know, the coaches stayed on him too, when it would be, you know, kind of easy to say, oh, you know, LSU's involved and move on. But they stuck with it. They landed him. And not only did they land him, but as you know, they landed him at a position that they absolutely needed to fill in tight end. Nobody younger than a junior in eligibility. We know that tight end should be a big part of Scott Frost's offense. It really hasn't been at Nebraska because they haven't had that guy over the middle to make those plays. And now, you know, Fedoni's there. So massive win for Nebraska, big deal for Fedoni, and a pretty cool thing for Western Iowa too.
Yeah, it is. It is. I want you to take this picture with me for a second. You know, you're down by four. Maybe you're playing Iowa, Wisconsin, whomever. 5 minutes left. Guy goes on to the field. Quarterback goes on. Here's how it looks across the frame for you. Omar Manning, Wandell Robinson, go to the other side. You got Jack Stoll as a tight end, Thomas Fedoni in the slot. And then let's say outside there is Levi Falk, who's a 6'2", 205-pounder. That's 6'4", 225, Wandale, 6'4", 260, 6'5", 225, 6'2", 205. And you got Wandale as sort of that stretch guy, or Alante Brown. That looks pretty good to me.
Yeah, and then you could throw in your O-line where everybody is, what, 6'7", or taller?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this looks good for the quarterback, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Different picture. That's a good picture. And I think that's a picture they haven't had too much in the last couple years. They need to have a picture for the quarterback where if he's a half foot off, and half foot isn't that much when you think about it, he's not throwing behind a guy. He's throwing to his back shoulder. And I think the way they've built the offense or the receiving or the pass catching group, I think Fedoni's the 11th four-star. It's either currently on the Husker team or committed to it, a four-star according to some ranking. That doesn't necessarily solve all of your problems, but it's a start.
How would you describe what makes Fedoni different from pass catchers that Nebraska has? What makes him unique when you watch him on film?
Well, there's a couple of things that I think is true of him. Now, he plays a lot of slot receiver, you know, so he's not necessarily an inline blocking tight end per se. Right now, he's sort of a slot kind of guy. But there's a couple of things. First of all, his size is such that you're not going to be able to just bring, you know, a 5'11", 6-foot corner on him, you know, and Thomas runs a wheel route. He's going to be able to make a play over that guy. He's got good body control. He does a nice job of using his frame to shield off other people, and he's got a good catch radius. And so the first thing is his size. The second thing is his speed. So Fedoni isn't a 4-4 guy. I don't think he's Noah Fan, but he's fast enough to where it's going to be really hard for an outside linebacker to run up the seam with that guy. Now, there are some outside linebackers in college football that can bust. So that doesn't mean everybody. You know, there are some guys at Ohio State that can run with literally anyone. You know, they're 4-4-5 or 4-5 guys. But I don't think Iowa's outside linebackers are – they're probably 4-6-5, 4-7 guys. And, you know, you'd like to be able to think that if you get in a, you know, a 4-wide set or let's say a 3-wide set with a tight end or running back and Fedoni's in the slot, you can't just flex an outside linebacker like JoJo Doman out there and necessarily get it done. JoJo's fast enough, but is he big enough? So then you're having to pull a safety over, and he does a really nice job of getting up on top of safeties quick too. So safeties, when they're required to carry a tight end, he does a nice job of getting up on their face mask, getting up on them quickly, continuing the acceleration, and then a really good safety can probably run stride for stride for him with him, but that's not easy. And beyond that, after you say, okay, a corner probably can't cover him easily, an outside linebacker can't cover him easily, maybe a safety can, but the minute that you dedicate a safety to that, you're either in quarters because that safety's taking him man up, or you're in something else. I don't know. You're bringing your safety down and you have a one high safety. The minute that you start changing the dynamics of how these guys can be covered, you're leaving someone else open. Somebody else is available to make a play. And so the thing that Nebraska was never able to really get to consistently last year is, how do we get to the point where our outside receiver demands coverage of two men? Like, you can't just have that guy covered by a corner. That guy, either through speed or size, can beat the corner. And they didn't consistently have that. That was one of the issues. Omar Manning can solve some of that. Marcus Fleming is so fast that you can put him outside and he can just run. Alante Brown is fast. And so there's some things that some of these guys can do that changes the dynamic of who's open and who isn't. And once you start changing the dynamic of the coverage, that's when you can start beating the crap out of them. That's when you can start throwing the ball all over the yard. And one of the examples I can give is, this is going to be from a long time ago, a couple of games. Two of the examples I can give was the 2013 Capital One Bowl, which was when Nebraska played Georgia, and the 2012 and 2013 games against UCLA. Bo Pelini's passing defense, strategically, like structurally, is as good as there is in the country. He keeps both safeties high. The middle is closed. He has a cool system underneath where, if once you understand it, it's very hard to penetrate it with a lot of big plays. It's sort of a match zone underneath where guys kind of pass off coverage, and then deep guys are the safeties are deep, and you just can't get a hell of a lot over those players. The caveat to that is, if you've got four or five elite receivers on your team, you can, because four or five elite receivers can do anything against almost anybody. And when you go back and watch those games, what you'll notice is that Georgia and UCLA had the athletes to puncture Nebraska's scheme. Now, Nebraska didn't have the best defensive backs in the country, and at LSU, Bo will. And so he will have a pass defense this year that I think boggles people's minds how good it is. Not a great run defense, but a great pass defense. But when you have athletes that can then start to puncture that pass defense, and all of a sudden your safety's cheating over, or you have to dedicate your safety to a receiver because he's beating your ass off the line and all that other stuff, that changes the dynamics of everything that happens. And then you start taking chances, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Aaron Murray threw for 430 yards in that game, and a lot of big, long passes, because part of what begins to happen is you trust your structure until you don't, and then they beat you deep and all the other stuff. So that's what Nebraska's can get as an advantage. If you go back and look at Scott Frost's UCF team in 2017, you could not cover – they had an NFL tight end. They had an NFL wide receiver. They had two guys who could fly at running back, and Killens and O.J. Anderson, I think was his last name. They had guys that could fly at those positions, and you couldn't cover them. You couldn't cover them easily anyway. And as a result, there were dudes just running wide open all the time, because you can't cover four guys or five guys that are that fast and that big and that good. And that's where Nebraska has to get back to. And quite frankly, last season, they just didn't have it. They did not have the size of those players, and they didn't have the speed. And so there was a number of times when the best guy on their field was J.D. Spielman. You could take him away, or you could neutralize him, because Konovi Noah and Jack Stoll and Cade Warner were the surrounding competition. Like, they were the guys around him. And you could man those guys up, and you didn't have to worry so much about JD, because you could take him away. Nebraska is going to get to a point very soon where they can have multiple guys on the field, and you just can't focus on taking one away, because if you do, the other guy's going to be open.
Yeah, and doesn't it, it feels like finally we'll be able to have kind of honest assessments too of the offense, right? Like last year when Martinez would be struggling, you know, it often came down to, well, yeah, okay, he missed a few throws, but like he wasn't helped because, you know, those swing passes weren't blocked well in the perimeter, or, you know, guys just weren't getting open for the most part. And so it felt like it was this kind of this confusing dialogue all season where people didn't know whether to be, I don't know, frustrated by Martinez, to be frustrated by the offense, the play calling, whatever. And so I think when you finally have a good stock of wide receivers like Nebraska will for the first time in, what, 4 or 5 years?
They had a good group in 2017. It was a shitty year, but they had good receivers.
Yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, 3 or 4 years, though. It feels like that's been a position of weakness for so long that you know, now finally maybe that group can bail you out in some situations. Maybe they can get a jump ball. Maybe they can, you know, come through on a fade. Maybe they can bust a play, you know, on 3rd and 6 that goes 70 yards instead of, you know, catching it 3 yards short of the sticks, whatever it might be. It just, you know, that's been missing. As we've talked about Scott Frost in Nebraska and some of the struggles, that whole receiving position has really gummed up what they've wanted to do on offense. So it's exciting to see what some height can do, what some speed can do. And, you know, with the commitment of Fedoni, I mean, you think about who else that might attract. You know, if you're a class of 2022 quarterback and you look over and see that you've got that guy, you know, in your offense for a couple of years, that's pretty exciting. So yes. I think the ripple effects of his commitment within that offense is going to be exciting to watch.
Yes, I agree. So the idea that you can maybe attract a quarterback going forward would be appealing. I mean, I think the quarterbacks they have now are good, but yeah, that would definitely be an appealing thing. Kobe Brett earlier this week committed to Nebraska, a safety, Omaha West Side. Really like him. I think he's got a nice upside as a defensive athlete. Runs well, runs, tackles, just an overall good athlete. Could play outside linebacker. Might grow into that role. As it stands right now, he's you know, probably a safety. The rule of thumb is if you can have a 6'2" safety that runs, you know, a 4 or 5, keep him at safety, you know, I mean, all the better, but you could see him also drop down and maybe be an outside linebacker where he can rush the passer or do some other things. And of course, in Chenander's defense, you know, there's some flexibility that goes along with the role. So that was a good addition for Nebraska. They've moved up quite a bit in the recruiting rankings. So they're now in the 20s. I think on both Rivals and 247 Sports. I'd have to look at ESPN. I don't think they are, or they might be, but ESPN is not as high for whatever reason on Thomas Fedoni as Rivals and 247. That might be because ESPN doesn't have a lot of, I don't know, how do you put it? I don't even know what the right word is. They still don't have a lot of analysts up here that are paying attention to Midwestern football. So they may not have as good appreciation of I don't know how good he might be because they haven't spent maybe as much time up here doing that, but I think they're doing better in the recruiting rankings. And then of course you have one more guy in AJ Rollins, who is the prep tight end. I don't know how he did last night against Westside. Obviously Westside dominated that game. I think they won 42-0. But Rollins is sort of a prep tight end. He could play tight end. I guess he could play defensive end or outside linebacker, but I believe he's going to Nebraska as a tight end if he commits to Nebraska. We don't know for sure if he is. Missouri is a finalist as well. Missouri has a good offense for tight ends, and I think he's got an offer from UCF too. But if he picks Nebraska, then they've went on quite a local recruiting run here in the last 2 weeks or so.
And doesn't it seem all the more important given the continued dead period in recruiting? Like, you know, Nebraska, I think, is fortunate in some ways that the local talent has been so good in this cycle that they haven't had to, I don't know, force the issue or take another commitment from somebody who hasn't seen the campus. Like, we've talked about it some, but you know, since Frost has been here, they've done a good job kind of locking down the borders for the most part. And you know, you get a guy like Bretz, and if you land Rollins too, these guys are plenty familiar with Nebraska. They're plenty familiar with what they're getting themselves into. Unlike somebody say from California or Florida or wherever it might be. So that's absolutely just kind of a double win there when you can have some local talent that wants to play for you. And again, when you can't get any kind of visits going, these guys are familiar. And when you kind of project in a year or two what kind of mass exodus that could be to the transfer portal from all over college football, you know, you at least have maybe a little bit more confidence that these are players who are going to want to stick around for the long haul.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. We'll see if we'll see how it's going to shake out in terms of whether the early enrollees play in a January football season or not. There's going to be schools to push for that, which for what it's worth would at least mean that those guys are getting on the field and they're starting their clock, you know, quickly and all the rest. It would be fascinating to witness if that actually happened. Speaking of January football, so there was a story in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on Thursday evening, that Big Ten officials were considering a Thanksgiving weekish start to the season, Thanksgiving week. So I guess, you know, the day before, the day of, and the day after Thanksgiving, and then the Saturday after Thanksgiving, of like starting a Big Ten football season, then running the season through December, and then getting somewhere in a, you know, obviously taking a week off for Christmas or whatever, but getting somewhere in, you know, the February, March area of, you know, finishing the season. And maybe they get a bye week in there too. If you started in November, you get a little bit of play for the TV networks. You're not necessarily competing against the NFL playoffs. I think ESPN had something about that today too. Dr. Bill Moos briefly asked just for confirmation of the Journal Sentinel story. And of course, Bill Moos is on the scheduling committee, and he said there's no plan at this time. No definitive plan at this time. That doesn't mean there won't be a plan in the future to start it on Thanksgiving weekend. It's possible that that will happen. I could see it happening. I think there's a definite change in the room now, a big change in the room, which we described in my story and in our podcast last week, that the silos are gone. Mm-hmm. And so part of what's happening, the dynamic that alters in this room, is now that all of the presidents, some of the presidents, are in the same room as the coaches, the public, the nature of the public discussion completely changes. It just changes very, very quickly. And part of what happens the minute it changes is you start to see this, okay, so what's compromise going to look like? Well, compromise is going to look like, we might start this season in 2020 if we can. Now people will describe that as solely a reaction to the $5 Abbott tests that are supposed to come out in October. I don't have any idea. I don't know enough about business production of scientific products to guarantee that there's going to be an October rollout of these testing materials, and that the testing materials on the front end are going to be perfect. We don't know that. We just don't know it. There's always that presumption. Certainly Abbott stock prices have probably gone up, but whether or not it actually delivers on the scale and at the speed with which they say they're going to deliver it remains to be seen. We can't necessarily guarantee that. I think that the changing conversation surrounding football is at least as much about the changing dynamic in the meeting room and how the balance of power is more balanced than it was before. And even if the Abbott tests are a key piece in that, I don't think it's any coincidence that they probably were working on this before Abbott announced it. And now that Abbott has announced these rapid tests that are supposed to come out in October, you're hearing rumblings of this happening, because now there's some leverage in order to be able to try to make it happen. I could see the season going even earlier. I don't have any inside information on that. What I think I have is an understanding of human dynamics. And if it becomes really clear by, let's say, the middle of September that ACC teams are playing these games and the SEC's ramping up and things seem to be controlled on college campuses, I think that what Ronnie Green said on KLIN last week is closer to a reality than we think, which is, well, you know, maybe could we start something in late October, early November if things change? Maybe. And I think that's what Ronnie was referring to, is just the changing nature of this discussion. Now that the Big Ten punted early, they got their win over football. They won't win it again. It won't be that simple the second time around. You won't just win over the ADs and the coaches anymore, and the commissioner won't win his way, because there's going to be a group of people in the room who guard against that. And it'll just be a hell of a different kind of fight than it was in July and August, when I think everybody was just trying to get their arms around it and the commissioner was operating in a way that allowed him to come to the conclusion that he wanted to come to.
Yeah, you can really see him walking it back some. And, you know, in some senses it makes sense, because, you know, one, you want to keep as many players in the league playing that might otherwise opt to go to the NFL. So you want to continue to preserve that. You want to, I think, as much as anything, preserve your 2021 season, keep that at a full 12 games. Don't allow that to start later, if at all possible. So in that sense, you know, starting it in Thanksgiving, I guess, makes sense. But, man, it's going to be weird, is it not? If they start around Thanksgiving, your Big Ten schedule is going to be roughly halfway over when the college football playoff is playing out. It's just it's a bizarre dynamic. And of course, you're going to have the argument too that what really changed in, you know, 2 months, 2.5 months from when
power dynamic.
Well, yeah, but that's
what changed.
I understand that, but it's ridiculous that it would come to that.
No one will say that. And look, the ABBA testing and the science that changed. Don't get me wrong; those things matter, because I think that matters to a handful of people who can then go back and say, all right, we got our testing. We got it now. So we convinced you. Here you go. But what's going to change is the power dynamic. The minute that the Return to Tent Competition Task Force came out and said, it's going to include all of these people, my immediate takeaway was, well, the conversation is going to completely change. It's going to be a public discussion versus one mediated via anonymous sources through the national media.
Right. But if you're going that route and it is more public, then why not just start it in a month when the SEC starts? You can still do that. Like, I don't see why you wouldn't look for that, unless you're just talking about ego and pride at this point.
Yeah, I think it's a compromise between when they think they can get the rapid testing and
high schools are playing. It hasn't been a huge deal to this.
It's a power dynamic. This stuff can change really, really, really fast. And so people keep asking me, well, do you think they're going to play? And my answer is constantly, well, they've said no, but everything's a power dynamic today. Everything in our country is a power dynamic. That's all it is. Like, it's, well, they said they're not going to play, but if Ohio State wants to play and other schools join them, how are they not going to play? They're going to play. Like, it's so what you're at this point is, I think, a moment where some people in that room are going to be like, look, we have to save face. We have to, you know, the presidents are not going to just let this happen and get rolled over, right? It's not going to be that easy. But simultaneously, hey, we're not waiting until January to get this done if other people can get it done, just so we're clear. And so now that the story came out in the Journal Sentinel yesterday, and as we're speaking, there's all these, like, again, anonymous sources that are saying, da 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 da, here we go. They might try to play later this fall. And yeah, I don't doubt it. Again, what Moose said is there's no plan right now. I don't doubt that this might happen. I'm just saying that in my thought process, if it does happen, they will tell you it's because the science changed. I'm telling you it's because the power dynamic is different. And if the power dynamic had been this way all along, the first decision may never have happened. The key is that the commissioner was operating in a way that kept separate the athletic directors and the presidents and allowed a decision that he may or may not have wanted, but somebody wanted to be made in a vacuum. And anonymous sources were able to help get that thing done. Well, now that doesn't exist anymore. And we'll just have to see where it goes. I don't know where it's going to go. Probably it's going to go in the direction of, well, they might play after Thanksgiving. And I'm telling you, if it, in 3 weeks' time, if they're playing games, it might be even earlier. Because everything at this moment is a power dynamic. And journalists struggle with that because we kind of struggle with, well, it should be the principle at hand. But that's not what's happening. It's not what happened when they made the decision the first time. It's not what's going to happen this time. It's going to be who's in the room, who's saying what, who has the power. The power has changed. And I think that's where you're seeing an alteration.
Yeah, no doubt. You see this tweet from Bruce Feldman just a couple minutes ago.
Yeah, I did.
Meeting on a call right now.
Coaches aren't going to make that decision.
No.
They're not going
to
make it.
Real possibility that the Big Ten may try to reverse course and play later this fall.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think they're all reporting the same thing, which is the Abbott test is going to change it. You'll hear that changed it. Then you're going to hear, well, you know, maybe they can get this thing going, you know, in late October. First, you're going to hear Thanksgiving. I suspect by next week, it'll be early November. Like, it's just, it's going to constantly change because these coaches are ready. They're ready to rock and roll. And the thing is, the 12-hour-a-week deal is going to change once you get into October. And maybe you can have a training camp in October. Maybe you can do that, and then you can start in early November. Then you can, by then you'll say, well, everybody's got the Abbott tests. Nobody can say they don't have them, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I got nothing, man. It's nuts. It's a constant roller coaster.
Yeah. Well, last thing I want to talk about is just, you know, Nebraska men's basketball had a statement yesterday outside Hendricks Training Complex about police violence against black men and women is what it was fundamentally about. But it was also about racial injustice. You know, one of the names they mentioned was Trayvon Martin. And, you know, technically, you know, George Zimmerman wasn't a police officer. He was somebody who had, you know, sort of anointed himself the neighborhood, whatever. But generally speaking, it was about police violence and racial injustice. And it's just a continuing trend, I think, of especially Nebraska basketball. I think they've been sort of on the leading end of this. Of wanting people to understand where they're coming from, wanting people to understand that this matters to them, and they've had two head coaches. First, it was Tim Miles. Now it's Fred Hoiberg, who feel a sense of commitment to supporting their players, being able to have voices on this matter.
Yeah, it's a cool thing to see. They've been at the forefront with Nebraska athletics for a while. And, you know, to me, the story this week was that was just kind of an offshoot of what the Milwaukee Bucks did. I mean, to boycott or to strike or whatever you want to call it, their postseason game, just to have other teams follow suit that the rest of the day and then the next day. And then you see the ripple effects of that in Major League Baseball. I mean, that to me, when it was like, where it was like, wow, I mean, Major League Baseball does not usually enter into those kind of social injustice discussions. And so, you know, the Milwaukee Brewers, obviously from the same state where, you know, the shooting occurred, decided to postpone their game. And, you know, to me, it's a signal of something bigger going on, because if the Bucks can do it and if Major League Baseball teams are doing it, suddenly you're seeing an empowerment of athletes using sport as a platform, the likes of which we haven't seen before. You know, this just does not happen where athletes, you know, step away from a game and don't allow it to happen. And so, you know, Nebraska basketball is an offshoot of that. You've seen college football teams that have decided not to practice the last couple of days in observance of this. And then, you know, now there's some rumblings in the NFL too, that some players are coming together and saying, hey, we might decide not to play a game at some point.
That's right.
has even bigger ramifications because those are a lot harder to make up on the schedule than
right.
a baseball game or a basketball game. So Nebraska basketball entering into this, you know, dialogue, this national discussion too. And yeah, I agree. They're setting the trend, and they have for a long time set the trend inside Nebraska athletics when it comes to kind of using that platform to make a statement.
Yeah. I appreciate their heart and their interest in it. There's been many of these situations now at Nebraska where there's been athletes who have spoken out. I continue to probably appreciate most when Michael Rose Ivy, Muhammad Berry, and Deshaun Neal, when they kneeled. And then on Monday, each one of them all stood there for quite a while and kind of talked a little bit at they talked for a while about their thought processes and what they had experienced. And I think that was really valuable to be able to kind of sit there and, you know, have a dialogue about it. I appreciate that. I appreciated, you know, when Thomas Allen, I think, was the guy for the Hate Will Never Win campaign. And, you know, and I appreciate this group of basketball players doing the same thing. I think the dialogue is good to start, that a conversation can begin. And I think athletes feel like this is an area where they have a lot of experience, especially, people of color, black athletes have many of them have had experiences, coming into college where they had that, even athletes from other countries, have had those experiences. So, you know, I think there's an aspect of all of this it's an interesting time. And we'll see if the conversations continue or if there's more to, you know, more to come. Or if there's more conversations to be had, and whether that, you know, ends up in an outreach campaign or I could see a summit, you know, something related to like an athlete summit where you've got 5 to 7 athletes at Nebraska, the ones who are on the anti-racism, anti-hate coalition, but also a couple others, a football player, a basketball player, and there's a deep sort of abiding process, and they kind of talk about it a little bit. So that would be interesting to me to kind of hear from it. And we'll go from there. But I appreciated their comments yesterday, and we'll see if there's more to say. That's pretty much all I had for this week, Evan. This was good. We'll see what next week brings. Probably conversations about playing football in February or November or October or April. We don't know. All right.
Next week. Who knows?
And then there'll be an update on lawsuits and recruiting and all this other stuff. Things never quite end, do they? All right. Thanks to all the Husker fans who will listen and watch. And we'll be back next week with, another Pick Six podcast.